Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how the Trump administration's policies on gender impact people born intersex, and a summer movie preview. But first, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, recently announced that it would stop tracking the cost of the country's most extreme weather disasters. This comes amidst significant staffing reductions and a broader rollback by the Trump administration of climate change-related projects from previous administrations. So what are the implications of this? How will it leave researchers and policymakers without information to help understand the patterns of major disasters and their economic consequences? Can this data be obtained anywhere else? Joining me now to talk about all of this and more is Randy Cervini, professor of geographical sciences at ASU. Randy, good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So the latest headline here is that, as I said, NOAA will stop tracking the cost of these extreme weather disasters. Why was this data so important?
Well, it allows us to set baselines so that we can see how things are changing, so that we can prepare for the future. If we don't have baselines, if we don't have accurate data now, then we can be caught totally unprepared as we go into the future. So keeping a good database of disasters, of weather, of all kinds of climate and weather information is critical in order to be able to plan and mitigate problems that might take place in the future.
Now, I want to be clear here. When we say prepare for the future, one of the reasons that NOAA was tracking the costs of these things was for things like staffing and making sure there were resources in place, right? This was not an explicitly climate change-related data collection process.
No. It's part of the specific jobs of National Weather Service. For example, when tornadoes hit or hurricanes hit, people from the National Weather Service have to go out and chart what damage was done so that we can get a better understanding of exactly what happens, what happened and what can happen. It has a big role, of course, to play for insurance companies that if they don't know exactly what damage was done and caused by what, then they're not going to be able to cover costs. And that's an important thing as well.
Now, there are obviously some climate change implications here. The cessation of these studies comes on the heels of a recent report in the journal Nature, which had some jarring statistics on wildfires and human mortality. To quote from the findings, climate change contributed to approximately 15,000 wildfire deaths over 15 years and a cumulative economic burden of $160 billion. Am I right that these are also the kinds of findings that NOAA research supports?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the important things about that study is that it wasn't the direct fires themselves. It was the smoke from the fires. What we are realizing now is that a disaster isn't limited to just the thing that we think of. When we think of fire, we think of wildfires, we think of fire. But this was the smoke that percolates out from that can cause tremendous health damage. And the numbers, as you pointed out, were alarming that there is such a big secondary impact to things like wildfires.
Now, research like this, not necessarily that report in the journal Nature, but the research that NOAA was doing that enables studies like the report in Nature, that research, it's not like the private sector can easily duplicate that, right?
Well, not easily duplicate it, and it's proprietary to them. They don't have to issue it. So, for example, these disasters are still going to be charted.
Right.
But they're going to be charted by the insurance companies for their own particular use. And that data may not be available to the general public. They can adjust their overheads and their costs based off of their findings, but they don't necessarily have to share it with us.
Right. I'm reminded here of the story from a few years ago that I think it resurfaced again recently, where I think it was ExxonMobil had done all this research on climate change. They were alarmed by what they found, and then they just conveniently did not release that report.
Right. It's their own particular data, so they have no obligation to share that. A group like NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is a public entity and therefore has to be able to share the data that it collects. Now we don't collect that data anymore.
So this also comes on the heels of staffing reductions at NOAA. By some accounts, the administration has lost, or the agency, excuse me, has lost 20% of its workforce. Can you talk about how that trickles down, some of the practical implications of that?
Yeah, it's not something that we have to think of. Is this a disaster that's going to happen in the future? It's happening now. This last weekend, we had an outbreak of tornadoes over Kentucky. Kentucky, one of the offices in Kentucky, the National Weather Service office in Kentucky, no longer is staffed 24 hours a day. Weather happens 24 hours a day. Most weather service offices around the country are open 24 hours a day. But when that tornado outbreak happened, they were off duty. However, and to their credit, the people at the National Weather Service are some of the finest people I know of. One of the people at the National Weather Service office in Kentucky stayed on and worked a second shift and probably saved lives. That outbreak of 9 tornadoes in Kentucky killed 26 people. I'd hesitate to try to think what would have happened had not that one person decided to stay and work a second shift at his office.
Just about 30 seconds here, Randy. I know we're also heading into hurricane season. At the risk of asking perhaps an obvious question, what are the implications here for hurricane season?
It really does not look good. Unfortunately, the hurricane forecast by the National Hurricane Center just came out moments ago, and what we're looking at is an above-average hurricane season. We're going to have potentially 7 hurricanes, of which 3 are going to be what we call Category 3 or higher, major hurricanes. If those hit parts of the United States with the staffing problems that we have at the National Weather Service, we are looking at a very large potential disaster to occur.
Well, if you will, not the best forecast.
Unfortunately, you are quite correct in that.
That is Randy Cervini, Professor of Geographical Sciences at ASU. Randy, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Early in his second term, President Trump signed an executive order stipulating that it is the policy of the U.S. to recognize 2 sexes, male and female. The order also requires federal agencies to rescind a number of guidance documents, including ones titled The White House Toolkit on Transgender Equality, Supporting Transgender Youth in School, and Supporting Intersex Students, a resource for students, families, and educators. It is that last topic that directly impacts our next guest, J. Kyle Peterson. Was born with intersex. He'll explain exactly what that means in a moment, and has spent a lot of time learning about it. He's also written a book called A Comprehensive Guide to Intersex. My co-host Mark Brody spoke with Peterson recently, and they started by defining their terms and what it means that someone is born with intersex.
Intersex is a term which describes a wide range of inborn biologically caused variations of sex, which are not clearly male or clearly female.
And this is a chromosomal issue?
Now we're going to get into causes. First of all, we have no choice. We're born this way. Mm-hmm. And there's about 40 variations, but intersex always has a cause. Every one of the variations has a cause. And so the main cause of intersex during that first trimester is genetic gene changes. And there's over 100 genes, any one of which can be changed, which is going to affect the development and then manifestation of primary and secondary sex characteristics. The important thing also to learn here is that the causes of intersex, of which there's more than genes, but that's the main one, and some are not inherited, many are. Those causes diminish the power of XX and XY chromosomes, such that is why when someone is created in the womb with an intersex variation, the power of the causes then causes changes in that development. It's a cascade process. So when you have a gene change, that gene will then cause sex development changes such as that XX or the XY, whatever, you know, the infant's going to be born as, it can't exercise all of its job description, so we say.
Yeah.
Our bodies are just not clearly male or clearly female. And our bodies are also distinctly different from transgender. This is often conflated, and it should not be.
How common is it for someone to be born with intersex?
In 2017, the United Nations took an estimate. They said that approximately 0.5% to 1.7% of the world's population were born and living with one of those variations of intersex, and of course, the cause of that intersex. So what I did when, Mark, I went into Phoenix, Arizona's 2022 census, and I ran the numbers. And it is estimated that approximately 822 to 27,954 people have been born with and living with some variation of intersex in Phoenix.
That doesn't seem like that many people.
It's not. And yet, you know, they're individual human beings. So, yeah, right. That's right.
Well, and as you say, like, each individual has their own characteristics. Like, not everybody born with intersex has the same genetic makeup, or it doesn't manifest itself in the same way in each person, right?
That's correct.
What does that do for people who are trying to sort of live in the world or deal with their medical provider or gain acceptance or, you know, try to sort of be in the culture of what's going on around them?
I'm gonna fold in our statistics in the USA with your answer, because that'll even make it more out of the abstract and help our answer. I use the 2024 census, you know, for the United States Bureau of Census Bureau, and ran those United Nations numbers. So approximately 17,000 to 55 to 5,781,886 people have been born with and living with some variation, and of course the cause, in the United States of America. These folks, including myself, there's a lot of challenges. First of all, doctors don't get trained in residency hardly at all. That's one problem, because you see the causes can also affect other biology in a person, such as electrolytes. There's also cholesterol, or hematocrit in the blood, or up to 16 different hormones can be affected depending upon that cause. Some people have one or two, some have three or four. So there needs to be individualized medical treatment plans. Doctors need to know what they're doing. They need to listen. And my research has showed that nearly all the folks, at least that I talked to, small sample, maybe 250 folks out of the world, they don't want to go to doctors. They don't like how they've been treated. You know, and so they don't trust doctors. I've been treated badly, and I've been treated great. You know, and this is about health. So there's a problem with lack of education with psychiatrists, psychologists, you know, licensed clinical social workers, doctors, and it's not even a psychological issue. It's about bodies. So this is a problem, because I a lot of it's conflated or confused. And there just isn't an understanding of what we are. And actually, it's a complicated topic, you know, and we're born this way without a choice. So you get like folks who don't know, parents can be under stress, doctors, politicians, decisions, everything from bathrooms to, you know, binary birth certificates. It's a real challenge.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine, as you referenced earlier, that, you know, there are all sorts of genes that go into human bodies. And if people who are born with intersex have different genetic makeups, not going to the doctor, it seems like it would be a problem, not just to make sure that people are healthy in general, but also there might be other underlying health issues that need to be dealt with. And if you don't go to the doctor, you're not going to get them dealt with.
That's right. I've talked to folks with that, and, you know, it's not good.
Well, so what do you think about? What goes through your mind, for example, when you hear the president and the federal government say that it is the policy of this country that there are two biological sexes?
Well, I think about these statistics. We're here. And I also think about the biology of the causes which change sex characteristics in that fetal process. It's a fact. I mean, it goes on, and then that we're born this way. So it's painful. It's really painful. It hurts a lot. And I just think that perhaps they don't know. You know, perhaps they're the temperature may be really hot right now, and it is towards, you know, transgender folks, and people just may not understand us. You know, because right now, I mean, it's so painful. I you know, this is a country I served. I served AmeriCorps National Service as a case manager with homeless veterans, you know. And I think about my father who served in World War II against the Nazis, and my grandfather who served in World War I against fascism. I think about their service and my service. And this is a country I love, and it hurts me so much. You know, I've cried tears. I don't even know if we have human civil rights. I don't even know if we have protection from discrimination for housing or employment or public facilities. You know, it's pretty scary, and it's anxiety provoking. And this affects people's mental, emotional, and physical health.
J. Kyle Peterson is an artist and author of the book, A Comprehensive Guide to Intersex. Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a 1950s-era children's book about Phoenix history was almost lost to time until a preservationist found it on eBay. But first, tomorrow marks the release of Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Now, ironically, that Final Reckoning arguably marks the unofficial beginning of summer movie season 2025. We're now 2 summers removed from the supposed movie renaissance of 2023, which was largely fueled by the Barbenheimer phenomenon. But 2025 is already off to a blockbuster start with a Minecraft movie grossing over $400 million, Ryan Coogler's Sinners closing in on $250 million. So, our movie's back. Joining me now to talk about that, as well as some of the most exciting releases on tap for the next few months, is filmmaker and president of the Phoenix Critics Circle, Monty Yazzie. Monty, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's start by talking about Mission Impossible. I understand you're a fan of the franchise.
I am a big fan of the Mission Impossible franchise. I remember watching it way, way back when the first one came out in a theater in downtown Phoenix.
Okay. So is the end of the Mission Impossible era the end of any particular kind of chapter in film history, would you say? Maybe just the Tom Cruise chapter?
You know, I feel like, yeah, it's kind of Tom Cruise's farewell to this character, but I don't think it's necessarily the end of the character itself. I feel like the Ethan Hunt character is like a James Bond character. They can continue living on with a different character, maybe a different actor taking on the role. But, you know, for Tom Cruise, it feels like it's time for him to wrap up this chapter and go out with a bang, which he definitely is with this movie.
Yes. Well, when you think about chapters coming to an end, right, there's folks like Tom Cruise who are kind of wrapping things up. But then there's also movies that were kind of trying, or franchises that were kind of trying to get going again. And I'm thinking in particular of Superman here. I'm old enough to remember 3 or 4 attempts to reboot the Superman franchise over the last 10, 20 years. None of those movies were particularly memorable, even if they did make money. What do you think about the one coming out this summer?
You know, I am really excited for the Superman movie coming up because I grew up with Superman. That was my first, like, comic book character that I really started loving in movies. The Christopher Reeve character when he played Superman was so iconic to me growing up. And I feel like this new Superman has a great potential to kind of bring back those three elements that really make comic book movies come to life, which is a little bit of humor, a little bit of heart, and a whole lot of heroics. And James Gunn, who directed the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise and really brought some wonderful heart and some wonderful characters to life, you know, and these really oddball characters, I feel like is the perfect choice to like kind of start up this new chapter of DC films. And the Superman film looks really great. The trailer is really fun. You know, you got a lot of things that are going to appease fans who have grown up with this character, and I think bring in new people to enjoy this new Superman character.
You know, that's such an interesting point about James Gunn. I hadn't thought about it until you said that, but he in those Guardians movies got so much out of a character like Groot,
yeah,
who basically says 3 words in the entire series: "I am Groot." But people would tear up when Groot would say those words.
Definitely. You know, at the end of that first film, you know, Groot plays the heart of the film. And that last little moment that you have with that character is so great because it kind of ties everything together. And you realize this character, who really does only say three words, is the heart and soul of that whole film.
So is that what you think has been missing from previous attempts with Superman, that quality of heart?
I think the recent ones, definitely. You know, you get this character who lives by this moral code, this ethics of how he is a hero, and the world is just kind of stuck, like, depending on him to, you know, divert disasters from happening. And this new film kind of feels like it challenges that. You get this idea that society isn't so happy with who Superman is, yet at his core, all he's trying to do is what he thinks is best. And I feel like there's a lot of emotion to dissect from that, especially in today's current society, especially with how people are, you know, influenced by, you know, social media and all these different news stories that are coming out there. You get this great character who really is functioning as just trying to do his best and trying really hard to, like, protect people and save people. And I think if you watch the trailer, you really get a lot out of that.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, the cruder topic of box office. It seems like we're sort of moving away from an extended period of time where superhero movies were dominant at the box office. We're obviously talking about Superman. Do you think we're still in that chapter, or do you think there are other movies that are more likely to be successful this summer?
You know, I have a feeling that, you know, you're going to start seeing these movies are going to, especially in the summertime, are going to start finding audiences. And I feel like, you know, the one that I've been thinking about the most has been Lilo and Stitch, this live action remake of Lilo and Stitch, which the last few Disney live actions haven't done very great. We had one this year with Snow White that wasn't so great, but there's something about this Lilo and Stitch. I feel like because you got a character that kind of connects with parents now who grew up with that character, they can now start bringing their families to the movies to watch this character that they love so much from the cartoon. You get this great potential of kind of having that crossover success. And because it is such a family-focused film, it's coming out on Memorial Day weekend. You know, maybe there's going to be families who might want who want to, you know, maybe not go see Mission Impossible. I feel like there's a recipe for some success with that film. And, you know, and especially in the summertime, you got so many films that are coming out, right? What are you going to pick? What are you going to choose when you have streaming that's always there? Disney Plus, all these different avenues of watching movies now, you know, pulls people away from that. But for some reason, I feel like the summer chemistry of the films that you have this summer really has that potential to maybe bring it back to where we were a few years ago with, you know, Oppenheimer and Barbie.
Just about a minute left here, Monty. On a personal note, I have to ask you about the Toxic Avenger remake, because when I was a kid, just knowing that Toxic Avenger existed was like huge nerd capital. But now there's this version of it that's coming out with a little bit more of a budget, Peter Dinklage. What do you make of that?
You know, I grew up with Toxic Avenger and, you know, VHS kid, you know, movie store kid. You couldn't help but pick up that cover. And I feel like, you know, at the end of summer, this is like way at the end of August, you get this film coming out. It is wild. I've seen reviews. I've seen people who have watched it, and they say it is over the top in all the best ways possible. And I'm glad they are able to find a way to market this film and get it out there. I feel like that was the issue, is how you market a film so old. But I feel like there's something about this film with Peter Dinklage attached to it. I feel like it's going to really get those VHS movie store kids, you know, to come out and watch it.
Sign me up. An over-the-top movie for over-the-top times.
Yes, definitely.
That is Monty Yazzie joining us this morning to talk about summer movies. Monty, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Last year saw an increase in the sale of cow's milk for the first time in more than a decade. Sales had been declining for several years, but there was a slight uptick in 2024. These numbers, by the way, do not include other dairy products like cheese, yogurt, and butter. Marina Bolotnikova is deputy editor at Vox's Future Perfect section and has written about this. My co-host Mark Brody spoke with her earlier and asked what exactly we're seeing in terms of people drinking more cow's milk versus plant-based milks.
Yeah, so cow's milk consumption in the U.S. was up just a bit last year, by a little under 1%. And that's significant because the long-term trend for many decades has been that milk consumption has been plummeting. So the uptick in 2024 is the first uptick in milk consumption we've seen in 15 years. Overall, dairy hasn't been getting less popular, but cow's milk, which is described in the industry usually as fluid milk, has, you know, plummeted since World War II. And so the uptick last year is notable. And at the same time, sales of plant-based milks like oat milk, soy milk, almond milk have gone down quite a bit in 2024. They declined by about 5%, both in dollars and in unit sales, like the number of bottles or cartons sold. So it's been quite a shift.
Even with cow's milk consumption going down, I'm curious where it ranked in terms of like the number of cartons sold or how much of it was sold relative to some of the plant-based milks. Like even when it was going down, was cow's milk still generally more popular than plant-based milk?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, cow's milk has always been the overwhelming majority of the milk market. Last year, you know, cow's milk was over 86% of the milk market, and all plant-based milks were, you know, the rest of the less than 14%. Like we can say that cow's milk's popularity has been plummeting for 80 years, and that's a true statement, but it's still, you know, it is still purchased by 90% of American households, and it's still like far more popular than plant-based milks.
To what do folks who are knowledgeable about this kind of thing attribute the fact that even it, though it's a slight uptick, there is now an uptick in the consumption of cow's milk?
Yeah. So it probably wouldn't surprise you to know that there are a few different explanations. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen quite a cultural and political vibe shift in the United States in the last couple of years. And I think the shift back to cow's milk kind of goes hand in hand with that. It feels, you know, today it feels almost rebellious to choose cow's milk now after plant-based milk reached cultural ubiquity in the 20-teens and had kind of like a cool factor. You know, and I think it also corresponds to the emergence of kind of like politically inflected trad culture that is shaping the way people eat. There's been a real push in those spaces toward eating more animal products, which are perceived as being natural and health promoting and, you know, offering protein. Raw milk, which is milk that hasn't been pasteurized to kill pathogens, has mm-hmm. seen huge double-digit percentage growth last year, though it still makes up a really small share of overall milk sales. The way I broke it down in the piece, what's driving the renewed interest in fluid milk is kind of the three P's, price, protein, and perception. The first one is kind of obvious. People have been struggling with inflation and high grocery prices, and cow's milk is pretty much always going to be less expensive than plant-based milk. The second one, protein. Americans are obsessed with protein. They're trying to get more of it. And cow's milk is pretty high in protein. I want to avoid talking about the plant-based milks as though they're homogenous, because sure, they're really not. The types of plant-based milks that are low in protein, like almond, oat milk, have seen the steepest declines in sales. But it's worth pointing out that soy milk, which is the milk that I'm a real cheerleader for, it's higher in protein as a share of calories than whole milk, 2% milk, and 1% milk. And it's also much lower in sugar and saturated fat. And indeed, what we've seen is that within the plant-based milk category, soy is actually not declining. It's grown modestly. And the third P, perception, is kind of my term for consumer perceptions of cow's milk and of plant-based milk and the health impacts of those choices.
So there's been a lot of talk for a while now about sort of the environmental impact of cows on ranches. You often described, beef cattle. I'm curious, what are some of the issues with increased milk consumption, cow's milk consumption? I mean, the headline of your piece is called "Americans Are Drinking More Cow's Milk. Here's Why That's a Problem." Why is this a problem?
Yeah, you're totally right about the environmental impacts. Beef is like the notorious climate food, and it's definitely, you know, and it has a higher environmental impact along most indicators like greenhouse gas emissions than dairy. But dairy is very much up there, and it's far higher in greenhouse gas emissions in water use, because if you think about dairy cows, these are really large, 1,500-pound mammals that we're basically mass producing for their milk. They're resource intensive, and so cow's milk, on a per serving basis, cow's milk is much higher in greenhouse gas emissions and water use, water pollution, and land use than plant-based milks.
I'm wondering about the taste component. Like, obviously, all of these milks taste a little bit different, and various people have, different people have different tastes for things. Like, is there an aspect here where people just maybe, or some of them, like the taste of cow's milk more than they like the taste of oat milk or almond milk or soy milk or any of the others?
I think that's probably part of it. One consumer expert I talked to at Nielsen, mentioned this explanation. Whole milk, which has seen particularly fast growth last year, it has this, rich, full-bodied quality, right? Whereas almond milk, it's extremely thin and extremely, low in calories and watery. So, the desire for the richness of cow's milk, I'm sure has something to do with it. I guess that would raise questions for me about why, if people prefer cow's milk to some of the alternatives, why hadn't they been expressing that preference more before? Like, why the shift in 2024?
For people who study this kind of thing, do they seem to think that what we saw in 2024 is that the beginning of sort of a resurgence of cow's milk, or is it more of like a temporary blip that more people are drinking cow's milk than have been over the past number of decades?
I think it's too early to tell. And I generally don't want like to try to predict the future. And I think it really is too early to tell. And the different, advocates on both sides, like to say that their, ultimately their narrative is going to end up being triumphant.
Marina Bolotnikova is deputy editor at Vox's Future Perfect section. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Kimberly Marshall is a professor at ASU's School of Music. Her specialty is the organ, one of the world's oldest instruments. Marshall is editing a forthcoming book called The Encyclopedia of the Organ. And one of the reasons she's passionate about the organ is that she sees it as more than an instrument. The organ, she told me recently, is many things: a work of extraordinary physical architecture and a story of power and the people who wield it. And some of the most significant characters in that story are women.
The first recorded organist in history was a woman. Her name was Thais, and she was the wife of the inventor of the hydrolis, which is the first type of organ that we have records of. If we move on into Roman times, we see women playing the hydrolis in mosaics that document gladiatorial events.
This might be tricky, but could I ask you to kind of describe the sound that the hydrolis might have made? I mean, I'm guessing there aren't any recordings of it, but what do we know about how similar that sound would have been to the sound we might be hearing in our heads when we think about a church organ?
Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, many people have tried to answer it. We do have accounts that the instruments were very loud. They were played outdoors, obviously for the gladiator events and things. So they must have made quite a noise.
So that kind of very front and center presence is, I'm speaking very generally here, of course, but not the kind of thing that we associate with women throughout history. Oftentimes, women have been more relegated to behind the scenes, and not been celebrated for taking up space in that way. Am I right in assuming that it would have been significant for women to be in a place to make this much noise in public?
Yes and no. Once the Roman Empire fell, the organ was lost in the West. And it wasn't until the 8th century that a diplomatic team from the Byzantine emperor went to visit Pippin, the father of Charlemagne, who was the king of the Franks. And they had, as part of the gifts that they bestowed upon the Frankish king, an organ. And this set the court at Aachen completely into astonishment.
Yeah.
They'd never seen anything like this, even though, of course, the Romans had had the technology, but it had been lost.
Right.
It made such an impact that then the court at Aachen decided we have to be able to build organs. It would be as if China sent an iPhone to us.
Right.
We had nothing like that kind of technology.
Boy, it's so interesting to think of the organ as tantamount to something like an iPhone. But I hear what you're saying, that it at the time, it was not just a sonic marvel. It was a technological marvel.
It really was. We often say it was the computer of the Middle Ages, because only the very most educated monks, usually, because they were literate and they preserved this information, were able to build organs, and they usually were patronized by kings. And by the 13th century, we have the head of the Franciscan order saying that the organ, and only the organ, is the instrument of the church. We have to remember that the organ is an institutional instrument.
Right. Well, given the amount of space that an organ takes up and just the visually overwhelming nature of it, leaving, you know, the sound of it aside, it's very interesting to think of the idea that institutions would kind of organize themselves around having this phenomenal structure.
Exactly. Alongside that, though, there was the cultivation of small instruments that might only have two rows of pipes that would be used for home devotions. And women were very involved with this side of things. In 1460, we have a reference to Bianca de' Medici, obviously a very powerful, important Florentine family. And she played for the Pope and his entourage when they visited Florence in 1460. She would have been 14 years old at that time. It's an interesting confirmation, I think, that a woman would be playing the organ as part of her hospitality to a visiting dignitary.
What drew you personally to not just studying the organ, but playing it?
All of the colors.
You're talking about the colors of the colors of the sound?
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
We say that the most important stop on any organ is the room in which the organ sits, because you can take an organ out of Notre Dame and put it somewhere else and it will not sound very impressive. Or you can take a very small organ and then you put it in the right sort of acoustic and a hall that's really meant to enhance the sound of that instrument, and it will bloom.
What do you think is the importance for people, not just of understanding all of the remarkable religious history, sonic history of the organ, but also the role that women played in establishing it?
I think, first of all, they were supporting their families. Like the earliest organist was supporting her husband by playing the instrument he created. I think that they were really helpmates. We have women developing skills and being able to play the organ in different contexts. More recently, in the 20th and 21st centuries, we have a plethora of women who are concert artists, able to stun the public with their virtuosity, able to improvise, able to record, to make recordings. Marie-Claire Alain, the French organist, is the most recorded organist in history. Not most recorded female organist, but most recorded organist. And she was a great advocate also for the music of her brother. So she's sort of including that aspect of being a helpmate, an advocate for the instrument. So I'm very excited to be representing that long tradition as are the many women across the world who are playing the organ, who are teaching the organ, who are trying to share this wonderful culture.
You know, I have this sense, hearing you say all of this, Kimberly, that you were talking about how for you, you were really drawn to the wide range of sonic coloration that you could make with an organ. And just in unspooling that history of women's relationship to the organ over the centuries, you're also talking about the different tones of women's relationship to society and culture.
I think that's very perceptive. I really think that the organ is sort of a symbol for a community, for things working together to make a musical result, or maybe even just a cultural result, that's far greater than the sum of its parts.
Well, Kimberly Marshall is a professor of organ at ASU's School of Music, Dance, and Theater. Kimberly, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam. It's been a real pleasure.
And you're listening to the sounds of Kimberly Marshall herself playing the organ, and you're listening to it on the show. Good morning. Welcome back once again to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. As the school year draws to a close, KJZZ's Robert Pala and Athena Ankara caught up with a class of fourth graders at Capital Elementary School in Phoenix to listen in on a unique story time.
Steve Schumacher phoned me a couple of months ago. He'd been poking around the internet looking for a children's book about the founding of Phoenix. There are coloring books with historical facts and stories about parts of Arizona history, but nothing telling the story of the founding of the city. He was calling to say he'd finally found one on eBay. I've known Schumacher for years, even before Mayor Kate Gallego made him the official historian for the city of Phoenix. Schumacher is a preservationist and a local history buff, and our paths have crossed many times. The book he found is called Hay for Horses, and not only was it written for a young audience, it was written and illustrated by children in 1950.
I do not know of another children's book in existence about Phoenix history. I am the only person with the only copy of the only children's book about Phoenix, and I would love to be proven wrong.
The book, it turns out, was more a class project than anything else, a manuscript of a book that was never published. The eBay seller bought it at the annual VNSA used book sale in Phoenix.
In 1950, there was an elementary school on the campus of ASU, which was Arizona State College at that time. And an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old did the illustrations, and another couple of people got together with the text, and obviously a teacher did the typing or whatever.
Schumacher started working with local school administrators to bring the book to Phoenix schools.
In my heart of hearts and my historian hat on, if we expect any of this to stick, it's got to be with these kids. That's why I just love sitting in the back and watching these kids be engaged, because that means it will last, even when I'm horizontal.
On one of the final days of the school year, KJZZ producer Athena Ankara and I slipped into a classroom to hear Hay for Horses read to a group of fourth graders at Capital Elementary School.
Will you guys say hi?
Hi!
Schumacher was accompanied by Dr. Sarah Galletti, the director of curriculum at Phoenix Elementary School District, and Michael Hansen, a learning coordinator who read to the kids.
I'm sure you think the story is about some horses on a farm, but no, it is not. It is really a story about a city, about the capital city of the state of Arizona. In the year 1866, 159 years ago, a farmer had a hay camp. The hay camp was near the place where the city of Phoenix now stands. It was along the banks of the Salt River. The farmer's name was John Y.T. Smith. Mr. Smith had promised to sell hay to the army men at Fort McDowell, 35 miles away.
Right away, the fourth graders were deeply engaged with this book written almost 80 years ago by kids around their same age.
What about McDowell? Have we heard that name before?
That's a street.
That's a street.
I live there.
The story continued.
The hay was wild. No man had ever sown the seed. This was wild hay. Hay was good food for horses at Fort McDowell. Some Native Americans and people helped cut it.
As we sat in the back of the room, watching students hear the story of the founding of Phoenix, Robert and I couldn't help but notice the irony. The text tells the story of how our city was founded by a trio of white men after rancher Jack Swilling noticed that the canal system could be used to provide water to a fledgling town. But shouldn't the Native Americans who built those canals be more central to the story? It felt wrong to sit in a room full of kids of color hearing an almost all-white narrative. The book only touches on how the canals were built by indigenous people, referred to as Indians in the text. It was 1950, and that word was still in use.
Hansen changed each reference to Indians to Native Americans as he read.
Mr. Swilling knew he had dug, who had dug those ditches. He knew that many, many years ago, some Native Americans had lived in the valley, and they had dug ditches. They had made the water of the Salt River run into the ditches or canals.
The effort to bring the book to Phoenix schools is still in its infancy, so Schumacher says there's time to adjust how the book gets presented and discussed.
Did you like the story? Did you enjoy it?
Imagine our capital.
And who knows? Maybe the kids of today will write their own histories of Phoenix that kids will get to hear 75 years from now. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Athena Ankra.
And I'm Robert Pela.
Well, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to have an excellent rest of your Thursday. And before you spend your Friday night with Ethan Hunt, we hope you will spend your Friday morning with us. We'll be right back here tomorrow at 9 a.m. Thank you so much for listening today. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you tomorrow.